listen to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
All right, welcome back to another episode of Rogue Startups. Today we have on Val Geisler, and we're going to be talking all about dinner parties. So Val, how's it going?
Good. How are you, Craig?
Good, good. I'm glad we could catch up. We have known each other kind of in slightly previous lives, I guess, going back a couple of years from your time at ConvertKit, and we worked with you a bit at Podcast Motor. So it's cool to be able to catch up now, talking not just about dinner parties, but about kind of SaaS onboarding. And yeah, we're going to dig into some of the stuff that I know you talked about at MicroConf this year, right?
Yeah. And thank you for helping to produce the Reach podcast back when I ran that show. It was really, really fun to be able to just record the show and turn it over to some pros to get the editing and all the production work done. So thank you for that.
My pleasure. My pleasure. So for folks who weren't at MicroConf or have been kind of living under a stone for the last year or so, can you kind of give folks a bit of info about yourself and what you're up to these days and why we're going to talk about onboarding?
Yeah. So like you mentioned, I used to work in-house at ConvertKit, an email marketing software. It's 7 now, and it's very soon changing completely. So I suppose we should all start calling it that. But it's an email marketing software designed for creators, and I was the first marketing hire there. I was brought in to write blog content and help with customer experience. And that was my background prior to going in-house there, was customer experience. So I've always had an eye for what is the customer going through? What is their journey? What is their experience of your product, your service? And what are they getting out of it? So I used to work on the more like service side of things. I worked with graphic designers and coaches and people who had really that service focused business. And I always used to say that they're people, not PayPal accounts when I worked in that world, because they mostly trade in PayPal. And that kind of mindset is what brought me to what I do today, which is now I learned everything I could possibly learn about email and more when I was in-house at an email marketing software. And I've brought that out into the world, the bigger world of B2C companies. So that mostly looks like SaaS companies, sometimes e-commerce too. I'm doing more e-commerce these days. But really looking at that customer experience, and it all starts with onboarding. Your customer's first experience of you in that kind of customer capacity is the onboarding process, whether you have a paid first month or a free trial, or if they're, even paying for a service, it's all about how they're onboarded. And that's where the dinner party strategy comes in.
Cool. So I totally want to hear, I haven't heard the whole kind of dinner party thing from start to finish. So I totally want to get into that, but I have to ask two things about what you just said. One that really jumps out at me, because everybody says, oh, in SaaS, it has to be B2B. So you mentioned that you focus on B2C and some e-commerce, which is obviously like consumers. Not obviously, but most of the time consumers. Why choose to focus on B2C companies in the SaaS world?
Oh, yeah. I think it's, it's more fun. When you're B2C, you're talking, the buyers, the person who's getting the emails, who's making the decisions, is the customer and the user, the end user. So they might have like a virtual assistant or another team member who logs into the account and uses it. But ultimately, they're the decision maker. and they're the mind behind why they're choosing your software. So to me, it's more fun to be able to talk to that decision maker on a regular basis through email and through in-app messaging and all those good things that we use for onboarding. Versus in the B2B world, a lot of times all of that messaging goes to the decision maker, but the decision maker isn't necessarily the end user of the product. So I like to talk to end users, whether that is on a software side of things or, like you said, in the e-commerce space, the consumer. I mean, that's, I don't know how much more B2C you can get than e-commerce, because the buyer is ultimately the consumer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was the experience that I had at ConvertKit that, you know, that's a really B2C kind of software company. And that I just kind of fell in love with B2C there. There's still a special place in my heart for B2B, but, you know, what I really love is that B2C experience.
Yeah. No, I mean, we were chatting a bit before getting started. So at this point, kind of have my hands in two different SaaS businesses, and one with Castos, you know, podcast hosting is very B2C, you know, B to prosumer, B to entrepreneur or something like that, where most people don't make money off of their product, and our line item in their, you know, credit card every month is an expense, not like an investment or an asset. And then Sales Camp is very B2B. And I agree, it is not nearly as much fun to talk to people about what we do, aside from the fact that we get to talk about making money, which is cool. But I think the customer journey is not nearly as exciting as, like, I'm going to help you create a podcast and get your voice out there for thousands or tens of thousands of people to listen to. You know, hey, we're going to help you bring in more business is cool, but it's not, like, I don't know, life changing. So I totally get where you're coming from.
Yeah, to me, you know, I do customer interviews when I work with my clients and help them with their lifecycle emails. The first thing I do is interview a large number of their customers. I send out a survey, but I also do on Skype interviews. I don't fly all over the world and interview their customers. But I get on a call with their customers and do these interviews using a framework that a lot of people, I think, are familiar with called Jobs to be Done. And so the intention is to find out, it's great that they are using the software and they've probably given tons of feedback about features and the product itself through tickets or even maybe even the company is doing customer calls to talk about the product. But my intention with interviews is to find out why they chose that product and the real why behind it. The best way I can describe it for when people are like, what do you mean that the why behind it? Like they need, you know, in the case of a podcast hosting platform, you know, oh, well, they need to host their podcast. No, there's a deeper why to why they chose your particular product and why, you know, why are they not doing it on their own? Why are they not, you know, there's all those deeper questions to ask. And I think about it a lot like if you have a house cleaning service at home, right? So you don't, yes, on the surface level, you hire housekeepers to have a clean house, but you actually hire housekeepers because you don't want to spend the time cleaning your house. Mm-hmm. And you know, in some cases you physically can't spend the time or whatever, but the majority of people that hire house cleaners are just, they don't have the time or they don't want to spend their free time doing that. And so if house cleaning services speak to that, they're 10 times more marketable and keep their customers around longer than if they're, you know, just throwing an ad up on Groupon and hoping they get a deal out of people and, you know, a one and done kind of thing. They're going to retain their customers longer if they speak to that need of freeing up time and, you know, the value of the customer's time. And that's why they hired the house cleaners in the first place. So those are the kind of interviews that you want to be doing with your customers of, like, why are they actually using this service? What's truly going on in their business? And I rarely talk about the product itself with those customers. I almost entirely talk about their businesses, what they're struggling with, what keeps them up at night, you know, what they're super excited about, And the why comes out of that conversation. It's really fun. And then we're able to take those pieces of content that the customers are actually handing over through these interviews and turn them into powerful onboarding and retention sequences.
So this is perfect. So you worked in-house at ConvertKit, right? Like as the first marketing hire, but talking about customer journey and customer success. And now we're talking about you as kind of a consultant working with B2C SaaS companies and e-commerce stores, talking to their customers as a marketing function, but also kind of like customer success, right? And so like I've used the term customer success for a while. We just hired someone at Castos and he's really great. But I've looked at customer success wrongly, I think, as an arm of customer support. So it's maybe a little more proactive customer support to convert more people in trial. But it really, I'm learning, is more of a marketing function instead of a customer support function. Is that accurate?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a real need in the SaaS industry to have these cross-functional teams so that you have marketers who are working on the, you know, customer success side of things. You have customer success or support people in regular contact with the engineers, right? So you have these cross-functional teams and even marketers and engineers working together. I don't think it stops at any kind of crossover because ultimately, everyone's job is customer success, and everyone's job is marketing. Because if you don't have those two, you can market all day long, but if you have unhappy customers, you have high churn rates, and eventually the marketing falls on deaf ears. And you, on the other side, you can have super happy customers, but if you aren't marketing your business, then you're going to plateau and have those really happy customers, and they might bring in one or two friends, but not at the volume that you need to sustain. So, you know, you really need all of it working cohesively. And I love seeing more and more teams shifting to this kind of cross-departmental work and creating roles that exist inside of other teams. I just saw a position posted by Podia, the course platform, and they posted they're hiring a marketing engineer. Mm-hmm. I was like, what? I've never heard of that before. And it's so cool that they want an engineer who has an eye for marketing. And that's exactly what they're looking for. Or a marketer who's made the transition into engineering. You know, one of those two things would be a great fit for that position because they value the crossover mentality that you have, where you're not just looking at this one piece of the puzzle, but you're really thinking about the entire customer journey.
Yeah, for sure. We called our role customer success engineer because the person definitely has to be technical. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have like a WordPress integration and then integrating with iTunes and RSS feeds and all this crap that can go wrong. And so we need, from a technical perspective, someone to really know their stuff. But we also have like the success part of it that's like, this is not just answering tickets and intercom all day. This is participating in the community and writing documents and maybe blogging for us and things like that. But this kind of brings an interesting point that I've been talking to other founders with recently, which is like we all, as a founder, we definitely have our hand in every part of the business. But as we grow from it's just us to it's us and a developer to it's us and a developer or two, and then you hire that customer support or success or marketing person, maybe it's all like in one, right? But from your perspective, when you've seen people do this well, so they're at like whatever 10 or 20K MRR, and they're able to hire somebody to really own a part of the business. And this is a super selfish question because this is like the challenge, right? Of like you have enough support to have somebody need to be in there a lot, but you also want them to be more on the success part. So like how have you seen like young companies or founders take and offload that from their plate to someone else successfully? Because for me, it's really challenging. I'd love to hear what your experience is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about defining the right KPIs. So if your KPIs are centered around number of tickets resolved or any kind of metric that is based on speed and you know those hard and fast, especially ticket numbers, then you end up with a customer support person whose goal is to close tickets, get answers to people. You know, they don't tend to spend, and this is a very big generalization, so I'm sure there are going to be people who are listening who are like, no, that's not the way that we operate. But for the most part, if your KPIs are focused on numbers of tickets resolved, then you're not spending a ton of time with the customers. You're not asking questions. You're answering their questions. It's like triage, right? So mm-hmm. we're going to fix this problem, move on, tag the ticket, you know, maybe let engineering know, and then move forward. And that's the goal from day one when you're hired into that role. When you're hired into a role where your KPI is long-term retention of customers, when it's interactions in a community, when it's outreach to customers, so it's, you know, it less inbound and more outbound, you know, how are you helping customers succeed on the platform? How many customer interviews have you done that week? When those are the KPIs, then you have an eye toward, now I'm really functioning as a customer success person. I am thinking about the growth of the customers. I'm being proactive about problems that might come up in tickets. And I'm still answering tickets. I'm still getting those you know, pieces of my job done. But the work that's being measured is truly around the success of the customers. Is it, you know, updating documentation, you know, creating clearer documentation or more on brand documentation? So, you know, your documentation is, it shows up on Google searches. It is a part of your marketing channel, whether you realize that or not. And does it match the voice and the brand that you're trying to put out into the world? Can someone in a customer success role who has an eye for marketing really take those pieces of documentation to the next level and turn them into engaging almost blog posts on your help docs that help drive new customers in when they pull up something on a Google search?
Yeah.
So, you know, someone who thinks in that capacity is really thinking that way because of the directives of how their work is measured.
And when do you like to see this person hired? I mean, I guess it all depends on the business, but what's your experience been of like this person is hired at this stage of number of customers or revenue or something like that, and it ends up working out well for everyone?
Yeah, it does depend on the business and the size of, you know, what's being serviced with each particular customer. So it's hard to say an exact customer number. However, around 5,000 customers, again, depending on your product, for a lot of people, it might be less. It might be 1,000 customers. It could be more. I doubt it's more. It could definitely be less customers though. But yeah, like you said, that 10 to 20K MRR where you feel comfortable hiring someone. And that I think is the biggest thing. It's not necessarily about, you know, how many customers you have or what your MRR is necessarily, but when do you feel comfortable hiring someone and paying a salary where they're allowed to make mistakes and they're allowed to try things and they're allowed to, you know, come up with things on their own, have that autonomy, have that true ownership of the role? That's when I think it's a really good time to make a hire. If you're hiring someone and you're like worried about making payroll every single week, and so then what tends to happen then is that the KPIs become really metrics focused, really, you know, like, well, I'm worried about payroll, and so we absolutely cannot have any churn at mm-hmm. all, so we need to answer tickets as fast as possible. You know, yeah, we get super short-term vision. But when you feel comfortable enough to bring somebody in who can really have that autonomy and ownership of their role, that's when you're going to have the most success from that person too.
Cool. I tell you, I mean, this is something I think Dave and I will be talking about more on the show is the growing pains of going from you, the founder, doing almost everything, or you and the founder and you as the founder and developer, to building a team is really hard. And I applaud folks like Nathan and Rob Walling and all these guys who have built big teams, or not big teams even, but just more than a couple people, and keeping it all together is really amazing. It's kind of my biggest challenge at this point. So it's something I like talking about because I'm selfish, and this is our podcast, so we get to do that, I guess. But
yeah, well, and it also depends on where you land as a founder. So if you're a marketer who's a founder, and your co-founder is an engineer, or you brought in a CTO really early, then it's a little bit different what you're looking to hire at that point, yeah, right? But if you are fall more towards the engineer founder side of things, and you really want to focus on the product and be that product manager and not focus as much on the marketing and customer success side of things, though you know that that's important, then that maybe that's where you're making your first hire, but and putting your focus on as far as hiring goes. So it really depends on what kind of founder you are too, and where you need to be focused to balance out your talents with someone else's.
Yeah. Yep. For sure. So Val, you gave a talk at MicroConf Vegas this year talking about this subject, and made what I understand is a wonderful analogy to a dinner party. And I've heard kind of Dave's recap of it, but for folks who didn't listen to our MicroConf recap episode or didn't go, I would love to share the analogy with them. And so we can kind of run through a bit of that for the rest of the episode.
Yeah, for sure. I love analogies and metaphors and anything that helps people connect to a concept. So, and I've already used a few today. I can, think back to talking about housekeepers that, it helps you relate and understand something better. So, the dinner party strategy is something I developed when I was working on the customer onboarding journey on the services side of things, when I was working with those website designers and coaches and that services world. And it really applies to the software world in a big way. So the idea is, having a new customer come in your doors, start a trial, have their first month on your software is very analogous to having a new person come over to your home for a dinner party. And I think the reason this works so well and landed with Dave, and he was sharing it with you, is that, we've all been in that position of somebody new to our lives coming over for a dinner party or drinks or whatever for the first time, and they're stepping into your territory. So you know where everything is in your house. You know how to get in if the front light is turned off, all those things, but they don't know. And so when people are coming over for the first time, you want to, you make sure the front walkway is swept and the light is turned on and maybe even the door is open. The house looks welcoming. When they come in, you take their coat and you offer them something to drink and you say, would you like to sit down? And you let them know where the bathroom is. And you are the host. That's your job. And so it's a very similar experience when you go through onboarding a new customer. And there's kind of like some key steps along the way that happen in the onboarding process too. So in my talk at MicroConf, it was really about comparing those little moments when you're hosting a dinner party in your home to each individual email that you send in your onboarding strategy for your brand new customers.
I love it. And I love metaphors and stories too. It's my little pea brain, but it's a way for me to remember and understand things well. So are we talking, and again, totally selfish, are we talking nurturing sequences to signing up for a trial, or once they've signed up for a trial to when they become a paying customer? Because for me, it's all the same spectrum. I think the customer journey from the first time they see you to when they start paying you, even after they start paying you money, is kind of a continuum, right?
Agreed. 100% agreed. To break things down a little bit, typically the word onboarding is used from the moment they sign up for your software, whether it's they're paying for the first month or it's a free trial. So the moment that they show some kind of interest other than being on like your main email list or coming to your website, there's certainly an experience that happens there. And that's truly like that's true top of funnel marketing right there. But once they have kind of locked into your system in some capacity, that is when onboarding begins. Onboarding happens until the time that they convert to a paid customer. Once they're a paid customer, then you're talking about retention. And there's short-term retention and long-term retention. But there's definitely, you know, I have heard onboarding referred to as that time, you know, that the first 30 days of a paid customer is onboarding. But really, it's that first 30 days, whether they're paid or unpaid. And for some people, you know, that unpaid period is 14 days. So you have an even smaller window in which to impress them and connect with them. Because that's the thing that I think is really missing is that, you know, when you have somebody over to dinner, you're not trying to convert them. You're not welcoming them into your house going, oh, I hope they come back for the next dinner. Like that's not, we're not trying to do any kind of converting at a dinner party. We're trying to connect with people and, hopefully making a new friend out of it, maybe getting an invite to their house, maybe having them come back. You know, there's a connection on a deeper level than there's no real conversion happening. And so that's the way I like to think about things. How are we connecting with our customers so that when we make an offer, that it's instantly a yes. Whether it's to convert, whether it's to pay for another month, you know, whether it's to have a call with a team member, you know, there's any number of things that a customer could be asked to do. And when you're connecting with them using a dinner party strategy, then you really build that foundational trust with them. And they're more likely to say yes when you make an ask.
Gotcha. So you, as part of kind of the service you provide to folks like myself, is interviewing customers. Say I am going to take this on my own because we're not at the point to be able to hire a wonderful onboarding consultant yet.
Yeah.
As you know, folks that listen to the show are probably in a kind of a similar boat to myself. I think as we think about implementing this in our business, to be able to say, okay, my onboarding, and I'll equate that to like trial to paid conversion ratio, right? Is whatever, good, but can always improve. As we think, okay, this is the thing we're going to tackle this month or this quarter or whatever. And using, you mentioned jobs to be done, which I for me is kind of like a term that you hear a lot, but it's definitely not a framework that I use a lot. Would love to hear about how you kind of go into a situation and construct like the approach you're going to use to talk to the customers and then looking at implementing that back in the business. Would love to hear kind of the thought process and framework there.
Yeah. So I do highly recommend there's a tiny little book called Jobs to Be Done, The Handbook. I'm pretty sure you can buy it on Amazon. I think that's where I got my copy. But I do highly recommend that. I have it right here. It's a 66 page book, including the about the authors and the table of contents. So it's a really quick read. It's incredibly valuable. And basically gives you exactly what you need to do for these interviews. The most important thing is that you are really getting to, you know, why they make the decisions that they make. And in that book, it talks about who to interview, because I think that that's where, at least that's where a lot of my clients say, like, well, who are you going to interview? Who, you know, what are you just going to take on my whole customer list and randomly pick some people? There's definitely segments. I always say there's three segments of people that I want to interview. There are the people who had trials and never converted, because I want to know why they never converted. What happened? There are people who had a paid account and canceled. Those are tougher to get interviews with, by the way.
Mm-hmm, I can imagine.
because they don't care about you anymore. And actually, those first two are pretty tough to get interviews with in general. But people like to be heard. And so if you approach it the right way, you know, and with a level of openness, I think that's why it does help to have an outside voice, an outside person, coming in and saying, hey, you know, I want to hear from you about this particular company. I want to hear the good, the bad, and the ugly. So, you know, it does help in that capacity, but, you know, it is possible to do it internally. And then the third set of customers that you want to look at are your high value customers. And so high value it looks different depending on your particular pricing model, but typically they're the people who are just about to move into that next tier of pricing. So for most SaaS companies, you have like a per user, or like, let's say you have a membership platform. Maybe it's, you know, they're the people who have under 1,000 members in their membership sites, but they're right there near 1,000. And maybe that's your tip into the next pricing level, where if you have 1,000 or more members, you pay the next price. So when they're right there on the cusp of a price jump, they're pretty high value to you, because if you can retain them longer, you know, the data shows historically that they will continue to grow. They'll jump into the next pricing category, which increases your MRR without bringing any new customers in at all. So those are the customers that are the most intriguing, and they're the easiest to get interviews with too, because they're obviously highly invested in your product, and they want to be heard. So that's where you start, is pulling those three lists of customers. And you want to aim for hearing, you reach out to about 20 of each, and you end up with like 3 to 5 actual interviews mm-hmm. from each mm-hmm. of those categories when you reach out to about 20, typically. So when you get those three different categories of customers on the phone, questions do vary, but the intention is always, hey, I want to hear about your business. You know, we're not here to talk about features of the product, which, you know, we can get into as it applies to your business. But, you know, I really want to hear about you and what you're doing, what you are trying to do, where you're trying to go, what interested you in this product in the first place. And again, the questions that follow from that really depend based on, you know, their particular journey. If they had a trial and never converted, you know, what brought you to us in the first place, and what did you end up choosing for that solution instead? You know, what platform are you on now? Like, no judgment, don't care. I'm not trying to win you back. I just really want to know where you ended up and why did you end up there? And they will tell you. They'll say, oh yeah, I chose this other option because it was cheaper. I chose this other option because they had this particular feature and you didn't. And I asked your support team and they said, well, put it in the backlog.
We don't have the feature.
Or, you know, right. Yeah. Well, we'll be sure to pass that on to engineering. So, you know, they'll tell you exactly why they chose something else. And then again, if they had an account and closed it, if they had an account for a period of time, like over 3 months, and then closed it, you know, what led you to close your account? And you do want to do your research. If you have that historical data, if you're using a ticketing system and can look back through before you ask that question, do your research and see if there are any tickets they submitted, any messages that they sent that would tell you the answer. And then you can actually ask about that particular incident and get really specific with them. People like to know that, you know, the messages they sent in the past were received and understood. And so if you ask them, why did you leave? And they have a whole ticket trail about exactly why they left. They're going to be frustrated. So you don't want to waste people's time. Definitely do your research on them a little bit in advance, whether it's through your ticketing system or even to look at their options. So to use that membership site example, and you have a trial customer who never converted, go to their website and see if you can, you know, check out, are they even selling memberships anymore? Or courses in any capacity? If they are, you can probably click through and see what are they using now? You can tell what platform they're on. And so then you can ask them that, hey, why did you choose this other platform? I noticed that you chose this other platform and that it seems to be working really well for you. What led you to that decision ultimately? Mm-hmm. So you're really talking to them about their business, their needs, way less, almost nothing at all about your product. That's for a whole different call. And then, you know, you have the option of sending out a survey too for people who don't want to do an interview. I love getting surveys. I always send a template of survey questions to my clients to be able to send out to a big old list of customers, because, you know, those survey results come back and they're incredibly valuable. And those can trickle in while you're doing the interviews. And then at the end of a period of time, you have all this data to go off of that you can use in marketing channels, that you can pass on to engineering, that you can turn into testimonials, that you can build into ad copy, that you can use in onboarding and retention emails, which is what I do with that.
Gotcha. So I think I love the idea of having whatever, a dozen live conversations with current and past customers and failed trials. How do you weight those pieces of input, which are, you know, a couple handful maybe, with hundreds of survey responses? So, I mean, if you have 1,000 customers, you send out the survey and you get 200 responses back. I would assume something like that is normal. And you're going to have similar data, right? And both, even though it's from different media, how do you reconcile those two if there's a difference?
Yeah, they tend to be... There's definitely overlap, right? So you'll see similar patterns showing up in the surveys and then also in the interviews. But the interviews tend to be a lot more personal. People will tell you more in an interview than they will in a survey, even if you have anything else you want to tell us in a survey. They just don't get... It doesn't go as in depth, and it's not as personal, and so people don't get as personal. And so I always tend to weigh the interview greater than the survey. I do, however, pull out any instances where there's like a one-off piece of feedback or comment or something that would kind of send up a red flag of. Oh, that's an interesting piece of feedback. But if it doesn't show up in any of the other interviews or any of the, 200 survey responses, then it's probably an anomaly. You do have that instance of like the noisy few that we all know about, that you have, 1,000 happy customers, but you hear from 20 of them all the time. And quite honestly, it is the noisy few who tend to be interested in the interviews. So you do have those anomaly comments and pieces of feedback and reasons for their decision making. But there is usually incredibly valuable stories that are told in those interviews that become beautiful testimonials and case studies. You really glean a lot from actually sitting down and talking to a person and not just collecting surveys.
Yeah. So this is where I may be a little skeptical of some aspects of this, because Well, it's the Henry Ford thing, right? Like if I would have asked people what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse, right? Instead of a car.
Yes.
I think to an extent, if you know your market really well, taking a lot of customer feedback is potentially really dangerous because people will tell you, especially that vocal minority, the wrong thing for your business. And it's tough, but then it's tough because you have to talk and listen to your customers. Yeah. Because they're the ones paying you, right? I mean, I have lived in the podcasting world for years now, so I think I know what the right product is. But we talk to our customers a lot. We have an email that goes out just after they've converted to being a customer. So we have a 14-day trial. And then about a week after that, we have an email that goes out that says, "If you had one wish," is the title of it. And it's basically, what do you want in the podcasting world that you're not getting right now? And it doesn't have to be on our platform or anything. And we get the most bizarre responses back, which is great. And I take most of them and say, it's just not possible, or we can't do that, or we're not going to do that. But we have some that are like, wow, yeah, that's gold, and we're going to build that. And so we have done a little bit of that. But I look at some of this as like, I'm going to go collect all this information. How do I distill that down into what's right and what's a priority? And then how do I go implement that? Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So in the jobs to be done world, they talk about looking for the energy. And so there's a point in a conversation where you, especially if you're leading it as the product designer, as the developer, as the founder, you have a lot of personal investment in the product. And so your tendency is to ask questions. I'm not saying you, Craig, but like,
that's
the royal
fair.
You, right? So your tendency might be to ask questions like, tell me about a different podcast hosting service. What did you like about it? What did you not like about it? Was it fast enough for you? You ask kind of these leading questions, right? Like, if you watch law shows and, all the lawyers that get dinged for asking leading questions to witnesses on the stand, you really don't want to be asking those leading questions about the product itself. That's when you tend to get into that too much information, not very good for the product in the long term category, when exactly what you were just talking about, that kind of stuff can steer you sometimes in the wrong direction. But when you ask them, like, when did you first realize you needed a podcast hosting service? What happened that made you go, oh, that's a thing that can solve that problem for me? They'll say like, oh, well, I was talking to a friend who runs a podcast, and they told me all about their problems in the past, and that they switched to using a hosting service, and they were so thrilled. And they'll mm-hmm. tell you the story behind it when you ask those energy driving questions. There's not a lot of energy in like, well, features and asking really specific questions about, what do you think of the speed of our service or our product? Those kinds of things can get you down a rabbit hole you don't want to go down. But when you really look for the energy and you talk about why did you make this decision? Why did you sign up for an email marketing software? What were you doing before you had an email marketing software? Or what were you doing before you came here? What made you want to make a switch? If you were using, so you said you were using MailChimp. Well, what made you want to switch to another platform? Cause that's a big deal to make a move. So, when did you have the first thought, this isn't working for me, I need to find a solution? That's really a great place to start of when did you have that first thought? And they'll kind of dive into a story.
Yeah, no, I love being able to ask that question, an open question, and then have people just go from there. Because I do think that's really where the insights that we all spend a lot of time and energy getting to that point of, you know, like the six whys or whatever, like, why did you do this? Why did you do this? Yeah. Why did you then? And then when they peeled the onion back so far, then the real answer comes out, which is the gem that I know we're going for.
Yeah. And I think that the most important thing in these interviews is that you cannot be afraid to feel a little bit dumb. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, you have to go into it like, I'm going to dig into any small word that this customer says that I don't understand. So you live in a world of, you know, software and building what works for you. And you definitely live in this world of podcasts. But your customers live in a world of the podcast is serving their coaching business or their courses or even their software company. And so when they say a word that you don't understand or something that you've never heard of, stop them. Wait, what is that? Can you tell me more about that? Mm-hmm. Why is that important? Because those are pieces of information that are going to lead you down a path that you wouldn't have gone down otherwise. When you go, oh yeah, I know what, you know, I know what that is. And I don't have a great example right now, but you know, when you do that thing that's like, oh yeah, I definitely know what that is. And then you're like Googling it later or while they're talking, you're trying to figure it out. But when they bring up something that is important to them, follow that breadcrumb, ask them about it. You know, let them know that you are interested in them and their business. Because ultimately, like, that could be totally transformative for your marketing, for, you know, that top of funnel piece. You could land on a brand new hero phrase for your website that draws in the exact right kind of customers just through following those little breadcrumbs of, you know, not pretending that you know everything about your customers.
So we were talking about Podia a bit earlier. And I know Spencer has talked about having kind of like an open call to book a call with them for his customers in like their onboarding sequence or, you know, maybe after they convert to customers or something like that. How do you feel about this as like an ongoing part of your customer success process? And do you see it implemented mm-hmm. well?
Yeah, I do. So Podia, for example, is at a point where they can still handle that. I'm a firm believer in there's a point where you have to get the founder out of being the face and the name of like behind the business, right? So, and we did this when I came into ConvertKit. We did this with Nathan. Most of the customers, original customers, came in through Nathan directly. They were friends. They were people he knew. They were people he did direct outreach to. And this is the case for most software companies. You know, you as a founder and co-founders bring the original customers in. And so, and you're answering support tickets and all that good stuff. But there's a point where, like you said, Craig, you have to grow. You have to hire someone. You have to get yourself out of a certain area so that you can focus on other things. And that's where you need to start thinking about, how do I remove myself from this process? How do I make it more scalable? How do I replace myself? And that's, you know, we spent a good year doing that with Nathan. Getting his name off of everything, getting his voice off of everything. You know, we started with the blog. He didn't write posts on the blog anymore. We eventually replaced him in answering tickets where, you know, nowadays, if Nathan answers one of your tickets, it's pretty impressive, right? And he still does answer. It's not that he doesn't answer tickets or want to help people. It's just that he has a lot of other things to do. So, you know, and the same can be said for many other companies, the size of ConvertKit. You know, Edgar is another great example. If Laura Roeder is answering your ticket, that's a pretty big deal.
You're the squeaky wheel.
So yeah. Or, you know, there are times where there's all hands for tickets and everyone's in there, including the CEO. And so you might just get lucky that day. But I really think that you have to be able to remove yourself in some capacity. So like you said, Spencer has this call to, you know, or call to action to get on a call with him. And that's great. And I actually have worked with Podia on their onboarding process. And one of my suggestions in that, like we kind of mapped out a framework of here's version one, here's what we would do in, you know, 2, 3, and 4 of this onboarding process, because it is never just one and done, right? So, I did say like, hey, eventually we're going to want to switch this out to like, you know, a team member hosting a weekly workshop or a group call of some capacity with someone on the team. It doesn't have to be Spencer. And maybe it is Spencer to start of, hey, I'm hosting this group call every Wednesday at noon or whatever. You know, picking a few different times and seeing what works for the audience and for you, but turning it into something that's a little more scalable as your business starts to scale up and as your customer numbers go up. Then you can pick and choose those individual interviews, you know, when you have the time and space to do that. But having some way to reach out, so, you know, in a as live as possible capacity, so those weekly workshops or demos or whatever you want to call them, those tend to go over really well, especially in the B2C world.
Yeah, I love that. I love that concept because we did podcast episodes with our customers for a long time, and that was really cool. So we would put, you know, say, hey, we'd love to have you on our podcast. And so, but that was not like getting to talk to them about their problems. It was really just a podcast interview, which is different, but it was nice to talk to a lot of our customers. We did about 30 of those. So that was cool. But yeah, I love the workshop thing. That's really cool. I'm totally going to steal that.
Yeah. And it's a really powerful part of like kind of a middle of the onboarding sequence. So let's say you do a 30-day trial, kind of around that end of the second week, you want to throw out to them, hey, we do this weekly workshop. And, you know, if you've some questions to bring, or sometimes people like to just attend a workshop because they don't know what they don't know. So they'll come to the workshop and just listen, and maybe someone else's question sparks a question in them. And so you write these onboarding emails that give them that invitation to come and listen, or, you know, chime in if they come up with a question, or bring questions that they have, and have the opportunity to get on a call with a team member and solve those issues. And then there's always the, you know, the PS of like, hey, if this workshop time doesn't work for you, please hit reply and let us know so that we can, you know, arrange an appropriate time or have a one-on-one with you. Because mm-hmm. that's really powerful that you want to make sure, especially when you run in a worldwide business, which all of us do these days, you want to be able to reach people in different time zones and all of that. So,
yeah, I want to reiterate that it's really important to kind of take a step back and remove yourself and any preconceived notions that you have from the process when you go into customer interviews and then writing your onboarding. So when we remove ourselves, we get into that benefits focused mindset. So, you know, everybody has heard, oh, you know, marketing, successful marketing is about benefits and not features. And I can't tell you how many onboarding sequences I have seen that are just feature, feature, feature. And it's just like, me, 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 pick me, pick me. But make it about your customers. Go into those interviews with a sense of wonder. Set aside the fact that you have worked endlessly for the last 3 years on your product, and that you have painstakingly chosen these different features, and just go into the process knowing that your customers have done the same thing for their business. So they've done that same amount of endless work and painstaking choices and you know, long hours and missed dinners with friends and all those things for their business. And so relate to them on that level and choose the questions that you ask the way that you would want someone to ask you about your business, and open up a conversation, and then apply that information to your marketing, whether that's top of funnel on the website, or if it's deeper into onboarding sequences, retention, ongoing, reaching out to canceled customers. That's another fun one that I love working on. So yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of ways that we can use that information, but the first thing you have to do is, you know, kind of set your ego aside and just go in with that sense of wonder. And that is where it does. All of my clients have said, I want you to do this because I can't turn it off. And you know, their customers do appreciate having an outside voice. Someone who, I don't know about every single little feature that you've built. So I'm just really going in with that sense of wonder when I do the interviews. But yeah, if you can do it, if you can remove yourself from the process, definitely give it a go and see what comes out of it.
You know, I think something else that for me personally really strikes a chord there is not just me being able to remove myself from features instead of benefits, but kind of like I emotionally have to bring someone in to help with support because I just can't deal with bad news all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And like to do all of these customer interviews with canceled customers would be hard emotionally just to hear, you suck, your stuff doesn't work, it did this to my podcast, blah, blah, blah. Like to be able to just say, Val, I would love for you to distill down the good, the bad, and the ugly. and you take those punches, and I would love to just have someone else be able to shoulder that burden a little bit. Because I mean, as a founder, like there's definitely like the element of fatigue around just the emotions. I mean, there's a lot of good, but there's bad too. And to have someone else shoulder that burden, especially as a single founder, I think has a ton of value.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to know that you have somebody kind of being the gatekeeper of the emotions coming in both directions. And then, you know, what I love to do is take all of that and turn it into data. It's all like I use pie charts and graphs and all those things that turn the emotions into data that makes it useful and tactile for founders like you.
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome.
Yeah.
So Val, for folks who want to kind of reach out and learn more about you and what you're up to, where can they go on the interwebs?
Yeah. So valgeisler.com is my online home. It's G-E-I-S-L-E-R, V-A-L-G-E-I-S-L-E-R.com. And you can sign up for my emails. I do regular onboarding teardowns on my website. So there's a backlog on the blog there. People tell me that they love these onboarding teardowns. Some of them have swipe copy that you can go and put into place for your own onboarding sequences. Some of them have frameworks that you can use and apply to your business. So you can check out the backlog, but then I'll also email out new additions. And I also send some emails that don't end up on the blog. So you get some content that other people don't get in regards to email marketing and that customer experience and how it all relates together. So join my email list and come hang out with me. And then I am on Twitter often at @LoveValGeisler. And come say hi to me there and let me know you listen to the show. I would really love to get to know you and say hi back.
Awesome. Awesome, Val. This has been really wonderful. I've been taking notes furiously throughout this. So thank you very much for dropping some knowledge and helping us all out today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Craig.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.